We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Trzynski, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by Ari Rabenhoft. He was the deputy campaign manager to Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, deputy campaign manager there, but also the author of the new book, The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders. Ari, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Never thought I'd be on the Federalist podcast, but happy to be here.
So, Ari, you've had a long career sort of in leftist politics and in various different capacities as well, whether working sort of in the official offices on the Hill or at places like Media Matters. And I'm sure we could have robust political debates. That would be a lot of fun. But you have an incredible story to tell about one of the most consequential figures in, I think, American political history. So if you could start off just by telling us a little bit about, like, just walk us through your career, how you ended up as the deputy campaign manager to Bernie Sanders.
Sure. Well, I don't think people need my resume, but but the part where I ended up with Bernie was I had kind of drifted a little bit away from politics after 2012, worked for SiriusXM hosting a radio show. After 2016, I decided I wanted to get back in to politics in like a more direct way than hosting a radio show. I'd met Bernie once, and I had he had come on my radio show, and I had actually written two profiles of him, one for the American Prospect when he took over the Budget Committee and one for the New York Observer, where I made the case that his blend of ideology was not some foreign blend of socialism, but actually much more related to Teddy Roosevelt's 1912 ideology when Teddy Roosevelt formed the Progressive Bull Moose Party in 1912. And I made an argument that was more the Bernie Sanders ideology. I would add in the other kind of place I would put him in American history would be the Franklin Roosevelt 1944 State of the Union, where he calls for a second Bill of Rights, is where I would place Bernie. And that's kind of where I was. That's where I am politically. And I had a conversation with my former boss, Harry Reid, and he was like, "Why aren't you working for Bernie? Like, that's who you are." And I was like, "Well, I don't really know Bernie." And he was like, "Well, I do know Bernie." And Faz Shakir was working for Harry Reid and was a friend of mine, and also was like, "Why aren't you working for Bernie?" And he knew Bernie too. And Faz made the introduction, and Bernie and I met. And I decided to go work in his Senate office. You know, 2 years later, it was me calling Faz saying, "Hey, do you want to interview to be campaign manager?" So everything kind of runs full circle in the world. And I had worked for Bernie in his Senate office for 2 years in a variety of positions, ultimately legislative director and deputy chief of staff. And, you know, it opened my eyes to this person who, and this is what the book is, somebody who is one of the most famous people in the world, somebody who is one of the most influential people in America, somebody who is widely known, as in if he walks down the street, kind of everybody knows who he is, but people really don't know him as a person. And I felt it was worth it to spend some time and write a book that described who Bernie was. And I wanted to write it, and why I wanted to, when you invited me on, why I was so excited was because I didn't want this book just to be for leftists. Mm-hmm. I don't want it just to be for Democrats. I think, for example, if I were comparing Bernie's place in history to somebody else, I think Barry Goldwater is the apt comparison.
I love that. That makes a lot of sense. Flesh that out.
Well, look, Barry Goldwater runs in 1964. Loses badly to Lyndon Johnson, but I think if you look at in terms of his influence on conservative politics, the conservative movement, and ultimately America, mm-hmm. I don't think you have Ronald Reagan in 1980 without Barry Goldwater in 1964. 100%
true. That's really interesting.
And I think it's really important for progressives to understand that history. I think it's really important for anybody who's on the left to read The Conscience of a Conservative.
Right.
Right. Just like there are conservative books I think are important for progressives to read. Like I, you know, on my bookshelf, I have God and Man at Yale, for example. Like I think it's important for progressives to understand what other people think and believe and know. And I think in the same way, I wanted to come on because I think it's not that my book is as good as God and Man at Yale or The Conscience of the Conservative. Not making that leap right now. In historic places in kind of American canon, I'm not suggesting that it's that. But I do actually think it's important for I think it's important that we understand each other's heroes and we understand each other's vision and we understand the thinking of people we disagree with, because I actually think that is actually vitally important for our democracy. 100%. That I become I'm a better leftist because I've read Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley. And I think people on the right would become better conservatives by understanding Bernie Sanders.
No, I don't disagree with that. I think that's very well said. And one of the most compelling parts of this book, which in addition, I mean, you are personally very close with Bernie Sanders, and a lot of that grew over the course of this campaign because campaigns are sort of crucibles and you were spending so much time, you know, not just campaigning, but also sharing bread and, you know, having meals and, you know, involved with family and all of that. But one of the most interesting parts of the book I found was Bernie Sanders immediately, not even hesitating, but eagerly accepting Fox News's invitation to come on for a town hall. That decision, Elizabeth Warren, you know, sort of immediately backed away from it, immediately rejected that idea. But on your guys' side, on your campaign, Bernie Sanders was eager. He leapt at the opportunity to bring his message to the Fox News audience, right?
Yeah, he felt he felt it was incumbent upon him, if he wanted to be president, he had to show he could speak to any audience. That it was important for him to be able to show that if he's going to be president of the United States, he can speak to every American and he wouldn't be scared to walk in any room. And the Fox News, the opportunity when Fox News offered the town hall, and earlier, I didn't actually include this in the book, this detail in the book. At one point earlier, right before the campaign, Jay Wallace, the president of Fox News, and Chris Wallace actually came into the office, and the three of us had a chat with each other about like how we can work to work together with their network in the course of a potential campaign, et cetera. And look, it's a weird moment for me because I did work for Media Matters. So, you know,
I think you say Bill Salmon was in the room and you had written about him and
during the thing, I'm like, eyeing him and like, you know, and, but the truth is we have different roles. You know, working on a campaign, working for someone who wants to be president is very different than working for an advocacy organization, right? And I think Jay Wallace and I basically, I was like, you know who I am, right? He's like, yeah, yeah. I was like, don't worry about that. we should talk about this. And we, you know, I think the point was not that I moved away from anything I did while I was at Media Matters. The point is the different roles you take on in different positions. When Bernie's running for president, he thinks there is a need to speak to those audiences, to go on Fox News, to go on Joe Rogan's show, which, you know, which ultimately was controversial on the left. But Bernie felt those things were important because it was important for him to reach every audience. And by the way, look, from a strategic point of view, it was important for us because you only reach so many people going on the same cable news shows every day, right? If you're going on CNN and MSNBC, they have audiences. Like I know sometimes people make fun of them for not having audiences. They do have audiences. And like, but those audiences are politically engaged and have kind of already made up their minds. And 7 minutes on a cable network is only so much value, has only so much value. So, you know, Bernie wanted to look for those opportunities where he could be in front of different audiences and really talk to them.
It's amazing. And I mean, it's not surprising. Somebody, if you do follow Bernie Sanders closely enough, you know, you would have watched the town hall and you would have seen that he differs enormously from, let's say, that field in 2020. I think maybe the only person other than that would have been the only person who could perceivably have wanted to talk to different audiences would be Joe Biden, but certainly not as eagerly as Bernie Sanders did. And it raises this question that I wanted to ask of, was it, you know, there was such bitterness in the Democratic establishment towards Bernie Sanders after 2016. Was it uncomfortable at any, you know, were there moments of pretty intense discomfort, you know, given that Bernie Sanders is this, you know, longtime independent, willing to take his message to different audiences, willing to talk to Joe Rogan, willing to talk to Fox News, willing to absolutely lay into the press. Can you speak to, you know, whether that was really uncomfortable in 2020 after 2016?
Not uncomfortable, and mainly because, let's be honest, the people Bernie surrounds himself with, the staff, we're kind of slightly pugilistic. So we kind of relish that discomfort. So it's hard to be uncomfortable when you like that discomfort. You know, like for some people, going to the gym is a painful exercise, and some people like the pain of lifting a lot of weights. And you know, that's kind of the Bernie. The people who Bernie surrounds himself with tend to enjoy that, right? You're there for a reason. You know, look, there's no long-term career benefit in Democratic politics for working for Bernie Sanders,
right?
Right. You're not gonna make a lot of friends in the Democratic establishment. And I've worked in Democratic establishment politics, and you know, I'm friends with a lot of people in Democratic establishment politics. They're former colleagues, but you're certainly not making new friends by by taking this job. So it's not uncomfortable because you know what you're doing. You absolutely know what you're up against and what the reaction is going to be. And it's frankly a feature, not a bug.
COVID broke the economy, and now a recession may be coming. A Federal Reserve survey broke some bad news, dating back to the 50s whenever inflation and unemployment have hit today's levels. History suggests a recession may be near. Remember what the last recession did to your retirement? It's so hard to forget. It seems like all of the time on this show, we're looking back at the aftermath of 08. So our friends at Lear Capital shared how investing in physical gold and precious metals can be a brilliant strategy against what's coming. Smart investors are buying gold and precious metals now for two reasons. One, gold can be a great hedge during a recession. And two, the closer a recession gets, the more your gold could be worth. Don't let your retirement take a hit like 08. Talk with the team at Lear Capital about owning precious metals for your savings and retirement accounts. Right now, you'll receive up to $10,000 in free bonus coins based on the value of gold coins you purchase. Visit LearFederalist.com. That's LearFederalist.com. LearFederalist.com. Yeah, it's sort of like in the ecosystem, everybody kind of accepts what role Bernie Sanders plays. And that's a good segue into a question that you address over and over again in the book. And it's sort of a point of pride, and I think reasonably so. You know, we've had Chuck Rocha on the podcast before and talked about this, but the goalposts were absolutely moved. You write in the book, Bernie's campaign was always about more than just winning the White House. It was about creating a political environment conducive to the agenda he had devoted his life to, making healthcare a human right, reversing the impacts of climate change, and making higher education available to every American by ensuring that public colleges and universities were tuition free. Are you surprised by how quickly Bernie Sanders was basically able to move the goalposts in the Democratic Party from 2016 to 2020? If you look at the platforms, it's a marked difference. Even a McClatchy survey found that. Were you surprised by how quickly the sort of tide turned?
Yes and no. I'm surprised at how quickly, let's say, the establishment moved. And what I mean by that is, like, you look at $15 an hour minimum wage. That position was completely radical in 2016 and is now the position overwhelmingly in the Democratic caucus of the Senate, for example, where you know it was always the majority, the position that you could always get enough votes in the House to pass it. In the Senate, you maybe had 15 votes in 2015. Right now in the Senate, you easily have 48 without even trying. And look, the difference is, how do I come to that number? Because the vote on $15 minimum wage, the one that was taken, was a little bit lower. The reason is the tip minimum wage is still a bit more controversial, which I think is important, but let's put that as a separate issue. Without that, you'd easily be at 48. And the other two, I think, are very, it's not as locked in a position as other things. So you're easily at 48, and you could probably get to 50 if you you could probably get to 50 with it. But you went from, you know, a very fringe position in the caucus to the overwhelming majority of Democrats
right.
supporting it. And that change, what surprises me is Democratic voters were kind of always there. Just like, look, right now, somebody says, well, Medicare for all is a radical position among Democrats. And it's like, well, not among Democratic voters. Democratic voters are overwhelmingly for Medicare for all. Every time you poll it, any way you poll it, any way you ask the question, Democratic voters are overwhelmingly for it, right? Democratic politicians, however, are much more divided. So it didn't surprise me that Democratic voters came to his positions, because Bernie's kind of articulating on a lot of these areas where they are. I have been actually pleasantly surprised at how quickly Democratic politicians have recognized how popular these positions are and moved towards them very fast.
Right. The platforms in 2016 compared to 2020, I mean, it was a remarkable shift. I think Kamala Harris was running on Medicare for All, right?
I mean, look, Kamala Harris not only was running on it, let's be clear, was the first member of the Senate to co-sponsor Bernie's Medicare for All bill.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie had never had a co-sponsor on his Medicare for All bill until Kamala Harris co-sponsored the bill. She was the first.
And you guys early on,
not anybody else. Kamala Harris.
Interesting insight from the book is you guys early on really did see Kamala Harris as one of your biggest competitors. She was raising a ton of money, and people also forget at the time Kamala Harris was talking in an almost populist fashion about things like identity politics. She would say, you know, all people care about when they're staying awake at 3 a.m. is, they're not worrying about intersectionality or whatever else. They're worrying about their kids and paying their health care bills, et cetera. She turned out to not be such a formidable opponent, but she did seem early in the campaign to be playing it much smarter in a way that maybe would have, you know, curbed into your lane just a little bit.
Yeah, I think when she launched, her launch week, we were shocked by, you know, she has a 20,000 person rally in Oakland, and, you know, that's a Bernie size rally, right? Like, very few people draw rep political rallies that size who aren't already the nominee of their party. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, you know, at certain points during her campaign, Elizabeth Warren, but it's not your average politician doesn't draw that, even in their hometown, even at their launch. And Kamala had that giant rally. Kamala raises over $1 million on her launch day, which was, I think, over $2 million, which was a huge mark at the time. Like, now everyone's like, Bernie's raised 5.6, I think it was, and Beto O'Rourke raised a tiny bit more with some fudging of the numbers, basically, but did raise a little bit more. Now you have these massively higher marks. But when she raised $2 million, we were like, oh, are we going to raise $2 million? We hope we raise $2 million when we launch. We better now. And we don't have high dollar donors to bank in. Like, she had, her and Beto had a high dollar program where they, you know, they called all their donors before, said, we're going to launch that day. Will you write a check on the first day? So they were like book pre-sales, they were pre-stocking that money.
Right. There's so many good anecdotes from this book that I want to ask you about. One thing that stood out to me was Howard Stern not taking the bait and having Bernie Sanders on the program.
This shocked me. It's also shocked me that this hasn't gotten picked up more in media.
It's really interesting because Stern wrote a whole section in his book about how Hillary Clinton could have won in 2016 if she had come on his show. Interesting.
And let me point this out. Howard and Bernie have a history that I didn't mention in the book. Bernie's been on Howard's show before. And when Bernie was a member of the House, and look, I think this is somewhere where I think a lot of conservatives get surprised when they hear this side of Bernie, maybe. But, you know, when Bernie was in the House, he was the one person who wrote the FCC and was like, why are you picking on Howard Stern? Like, cut this crap out.
Right.
Free speech. Right. Bernie is a civil libertarian in a very traditional sense. You know, when you've seen this when he gets asked about some of these issues, he gets very uncomfortable with any attempts, especially by corporations, to impinge on free speech. He's not comfortable with it, and he's not comfortable with government impingements on free speech. It's just not who he is, right? He's kind of an old school. He has an old school sense of liberalism on these issues. Liberalism in the kind of the traditional definition of the liberal word sense.
Yeah, it's like Joan Baez saying, you know, Berkeley kids, let Ann Coulter speak.
Yeah, Bernie would, yes, and Bernie would take that position that of course a campus should have Ann Coulter speak, and of course they should have, like, this is an, you know, you should have the speaker you disagree with speak. That would be Bernie's position on these issues. But with Stern, so we'd done the Fox News town hall. Bernie was like, that was great. What else can we do? And we were actually sitting at a restaurant, Faz and I, and we started listing media venues that were like, look, we should do Rogan, because that's and he's like, what's this? And we explained, like, you will not see a bigger audience than Joe Rogan podcast. Like, it will be the biggest audience you do all campaign. And it'll be an audience of people who you won't reach otherwise. And we think he's likely to be a very friendly interview, actually. Like, if
and he was.
Yes. And we think we're like, it's something you'll enjoy because he'll let you kind of make your case and you'll have time to make your case. Like, you and he, and he'll engage in a conversation about stuff. And even if you disagree, he's a very, you know, he'll kind of, he lets you have your point and you guys can go back and forth. And then the other thing we said was Howard Stern. Now, I'm going to be honest. I thought Howard Stern was a give me, right? I thought there was no way they're going to turn down this pitch for a few reasons. One, Howard has constantly complained on air that political candidates won't come on his show. And so, hey, we're going to offer you an A-class political candidate, not somebody who's like starving for attention, not somebody who's not famous, somebody who matches the fame of any A-list celebrity you would have on the show is Bernie. Two, we're very clear in the pitch, no holds barred, Howard can ask anything he wants. Right. And and I said I thought this was going I thought it would be a brilliant interview because you'd actually get who Bernie is as a person. I really thought Howard could draw that out, and I really thought they would recognize it. So I reached out, and look, I knew this wasn't like a random cold outreach. I'd worked for Sirius. I knew the people at the most senior level in Howard's kind of universe at Sirius. One of them had actually worked in another section of Sirius before moving over to Howard and had hired me. So I reached out to that person and I said, and by email, and I was like, hey, Bernie, love to do Howard. We have to come to New York, so we'd have to schedule it. Like, when can we do this? And reached out in the summer and said, hey, the person responded, hey, let me, that's great. Let me check on this. Came back and said, look, it's a little too early. Howard feels like it's too political if he has Bernie on. And it's like, okay. And he's like, well, he doesn't want to have every candidate on. Well, he doesn't have to. Like, Rogan was like, I'm having Bernie on. I'm not interested. I'm having Bernie, Tulsi, and Andrew Yang because they're interesting to me. I'm not going to have, like, it's your show. No, but you don't have to have everyone on, but okay. I should come back later then. Yes. Yeah. Come back closer. Okay. So we're going to go to New York in September. We were in New York. Bernie ironically was on the Dr. Oz show. Speaking of going on shows that, you know,
That's great.
Yeah, Bernie. I mean, Bernie went on Dr. Oz. And look, part of that was reach out to different audiences, right? Dr. Oz had this heavily female kind of suburban audience that, you know, wasn't in the Bernie camp, but Bernie thought was important to, like, expose himself to.
Right.
And so we were going to New York. So I emailed again. I said, hey, we're in New York on this day. Is this close enough? No, not close enough. And they were like repeated. We went back 5 or 6 times and said, hey, how about now? How about now? How about now? No, 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 no. Did a final time kind of at the beginning of 2021. And they were like, no, he just doesn't want to be political. Like, okay, but you've said for years, you've complained that politicians won't come on your show and answer your questions. Well, I'm like, here you go. And then, like, right after that, they had Hillary on, who bashed Bernie on Howard's show, which is fine. That's her prerogative. But it's like, okay, so Bernie's too political, but Hillary's not. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And like, you're like, Howard is Howard, you know, one of the greatest broadcasters of all time. It shocked me only because he had said for years, why won't candidates come on my show? Please come on the show. Like, we offered it. We offered it no holds barred, no limits, no limits on questions, no limits on anything. We'll come into the studio, do what you want. And they said no.
I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with the 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and a washcloth 2-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow 6-piece towel set regularly $109.99 for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza Dream Sheets, and so much more. Get your 6-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Yeah, it raises this issue of Bernie Sanders versus the media, which is another subplot of both 2016 and 2020 that I think a lot of people weren't paying attention to. But it's super interesting. And one of the things, I've heard this before, but you write about it at a bit more length in your book, the sort of intensity with which Bernie Sanders is a student of media. I mean, the guy has studied media for years. It's been a major sort of interest of his for a really long time. You write, while his brief career making educational film strips ended when he became mayor of Burlington, he remained obsessed with the power of television and other media. Can you tell us a little bit about that side of Bernie Sanders and a little bit about, you know, the obstacles that were actually and are very real for genuine, authentic leftist candidates, not, you know, Hillary Clinton, but the very real obstacles that, you know, the Jeff Bezos-owned Washington Post will erect for people like Bernie?
I think one thing that people don't know is before Bernie ran for mayor in 1980, his first political race he won, he'd actually started to develop a pretty successful career making these film strip things, which I might be dating myself. I think I was the tail end of like the kids who would watch the film strips in school. And they were like almost like slideshows with like an audio track that went through a machine. It would like put up a picture and then the voiceover would say, tell the history of that picture. And it was like when I was in elementary school before, like before classrooms got VCRs, like they had film strips. And Bernie actually developed a relatively for his time, for that moment in his life, successful business producing these historic film strips on New England history for schools. And the one that everyone talks about, he did one on Eugene Debs at one point, which was like his passion project, right? And so this, and he had written for some magazines in the 70s and done some other things. And media was on his mind. He becomes mayor of Burlington. And one of the things he does is host a TV show on the Burlington Public Access Channel, which I believe Politico paid to digitize the entire archive during the 2020 run of that TV show. So you can watch the entirety of, I think it was called The Mayor Speaks. And it, you know, what it is Bernie going around the community of Burlington talking to people. And like the funny part is Bernie talking to people in 1985 is not very much different than Bernie talking to people in 2020.
That's funny.
You know, it's and so he has that, but he kind of feels limitations of that early in the campaign, early in after the 2016 campaign. Facebook Live starts becoming a bigger and bigger thing, and video becomes more of a thing on Facebook. And he starts to see the power of producing his own content and being his own media and really thinking about. And one of those moments, I talk about this in the book, was he was having a conversation with a Sunday show host. And he was like, hey, how about we do a show where we explain the pros and cons of Medicare for All? Like, you should do a show and you bring on a panel of people who can talk about Medicare for All. You can bring on a panel of people who can talk about why it's a bad idea, but you should do a show. This is a major policy explaining this thing. And you should do these policy driven, you should think about doing some policy driven shows in the public affairs time. Not just doing kind of the news of the week and chasing stuff, you know, letting the tail wag the dog, et cetera, but do some like heavy policy driven shows on stuff and bring on people to have those discussions. And the Sunday show was like, yeah, let me talk to my people about that. And of course, never got back to Bernie. And so Bernie was like, let's do our own town hall on Medicare for All. And we did this Medicare for All town hall in the theater in the Senate. Streamed it. It got a huge audience online. The theater was packed with people. It had all these panels, and Bernie, it was kind of Bernie's vision that you could do media, that you could get millions of views on these things, and people would actually watch. And, you know, it's his. So obviously our panels were like 100% Medicare for All supportive, explaining different elements and things like that. But his point was you could do an interesting show on this, but the mainstream media would never do a policy-driven show. They're going to be more they're always going to want to wag the dog. I think in terms of our fights with media, they're kind of twofold. One is I think a lot of reporters are never going to understand where Bernie's coming from. And what I mean by that is, look, there's this whole like debate, you know, you have Jay Rosen and other people online talking about, you know, Jay Rosen takes a position, media can't be objective because for a number of reasons, and it's got to like take firmer positions. I'm bastardizing his his stand here, but I'm so, you know, don't beat me up for that. But my point is there's this whole, and then there's a notion in media, some people like, media has to be objective, right? The problem is, what is objective? And some media defines that as, you know, one side says the sky is pink. One side says it's green. Some experts say it's blue. What is it, right? And, but that's not being, to me, that's a fallacy, right? Objectively, you should be able to look at the sky, say it's blue, and reporters should be able to report that. But the other problem is, what if our eyes all see things differently, which they do, right? And what if what and my background, we all have biases based on a variety of things. We all have different experiences in life. We all grew up differently. We all see the world differently. It's actually like really great. And the problem is there's a lot of reporters, I think, are a lot of reporters come from a set of politics that they deny exists.
A sort of class criticism.
Well, it's not even, they don't have kind of class consciousness, because a lot of the bigger, more mainstream reporters, you know, went to like top schools.
Totally.
And yeah. live in New York and Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Very wealthy cities, and send their kids to the same schools. And look, I'm not talking about your average reporter in America, because that's, I'm talking about the ones who kind of lead American media and, mm-hmm. you know, come at it with a different perspective. I think when people say the media is liberally biased, I think if you are, you know, I think a lot of mainstream reporters, they are, you know, they're kind of very socially liberal a lot of the time. And I think that distorts it. But on economic issues, tend to kind of have in DC, tend to much more fall in around what I would classify as like this moderate, like K Street, bipartisan policy institute kind of consensus about politics.
Right.
More social, like reporters tend to be, generally, my experience with reporters in the media, they tend to be socially liberal and economically very moderate, if you break down. And ironically, this is one thing I will say about Bernie. And I think there are a number of reporters, the reporters I've seen Bernie get along with the best, actually tend to have a more conservative background, interestingly.
Yeah, that makes sense, because there's something about, you know, being against the establishment in your industry that I could see endear.
But not even, but these people, some of them are very establishment people. Like Robert Costa has a more conservative background,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
And Bernie likes Robert Costa, thinks he does a good job, enjoys being interviewed by him, for example.
That is interesting.
Right. Weigel, you know, now he's like, people accuse him of being a liberal reporter, but remember, he comes from Reason magazine. Like, that's where he started, right? He has a different, it's not a traditional liberal background. And there was one reporter who I'm not going to give away the name of, because I don't know how public his history is, but he's a major network reporter who ran for office as a Republican at one point early right. in his life. And Bernie got along spectacularly with that reporter. Really thought that reporter did. It was interesting, because those were the reporters I saw Bernie feel, not even, he didn't think they agreed with him. He just thought they were being the most fair to him and giving him the best hearing on his stuff. And other reporters, there was a general, I think I had this conversation with somebody who was like, I'm objective. And I was like, no, you're not. And they're like, no, I don't judge him. I was like, yes, but you went to an elite university. You've lived your life here. And therefore, when you say you don't understand why we did X, Y, and Z, it's because you're not X, Y, and Z. You can't see that. And that's, and look, not related to reporters on our campaign trail, I think there has been rightfully a lot of criticism for different reasons, I would say. It's like, you know, when the New York Times does their coverage of like conservative people, and it's almost like, it's like oddly like they're covering people at a zoo.
Yes, it's very much like they're examining gorillas in nature.
Like, we went to this diner and, oh my God, did you, it's like that scene. It always reminds me of that scene in Parks and Recreation where Ron Swanson is in the health food store and he sees the guy with the dreadlocks putting like nuts in a bag, and he's like, isn't nature wonderful?
Yes, that's such a good moment. Well, but it's true. So like, this is where Bernie cleaned up in my home state of Wisconsin, where Donald Trump also did shockingly well. And these are the types of things, the type of backgrounds, the type of people that are so completely misunderstood by the corporate press. But it's very interesting. I think Bernie Sanders' sort of criticism of the press from the left is fascinating to me. And I actually, since you mentioned Weigel, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier, was the civil libertarianism of Bernie Sanders. I have to, like, this might be the most annoying question that I ask you, and I don't even think it's that annoying. But the ways that the party itself has shifted on civil libertarianism, I wonder if you could speak to, you know, whether that was privately extremely frustrating for Bernie Sanders. He himself has shifted on issues like guns, like immigration, although, you know, the country and the economy has certainly shifted, you know, and there are reasonable ways to react to that, of course. But when you have the Democratic Party, you know, Breonna Joy Gray is very good on this issue, you know, not having the primacy of class sort of in their perspective when they are thinking through these things. Hillary Clinton bragging about how she won places with the highest GDP. It's just amazing. But from Bernie Sanders' side, the sort of cultural shift in the Democratic establishment, the Democratic Party, how frustrating, if it was frustrating at all, was that? And did you see that?
I don't know if it's frustrating. I think first off, Bernie's perspective is very clear. It has a very clear, like, place how he feels class and race should play in politics. And, you know, his kind of foundational experience in Democratic politics was the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign.
Mm.
And his point is the kind of rainbow coalition idea that working class people of all races should come together in a rainbow coalition to kind of fight for their rights. And you can't have that economic justice and racial justice are intrinsically tied together. That if you, you know, the Martin Luther King line about it's, you know, I'm going to misquote this because I don't have it in front of me, but the, you know, it's nice to be able to eat at the lunch counter, but if you can't afford the hamburger, it doesn't matter. Right. And I'm bastardizing mm-hmm. that quote, but that was mm-hmm. the gist of the quote that race and class, racial issues and class issues have to kind of work in tandem, and America has to solve both of them, that you can't, that if you do one without the other, you're doing only a portion of the work. So, and there, you know, we have this, we're in this weird moment in politics where everything is binary, right? Mm-hmm. And I think social media encourages that. And then the news media feeds off that and encourages like this, you're either 100% or you're 0%. And there's no kind of nuance to any ability. There's no nuance to our conversation, right? So you get weird things like during the 2016 campaign, you hear like Bernie Sanders is bad on abortion. The man has like a 100% voting record on that issue, right? Bernie Sanders is bad on guns, but like that just wasn't functionally true. There were a few issues when he was, early in his career, kind of that he did switch on that issue. But for the most part, for example, you know, Bernie in his first earliest campaigns was in favor of the assault weapons ban.
Right.
Right. And never changed that position. Even in early campaigns in Vermont, in 1990, when that was not an easy position to take, said, no, I'm in favor of the assault weapons ban. I think that's a smart thing to do. So, you know, because 2016 was like a binary campaign where there was basically Hillary and Bernie, if Hillary is good, therefore Bernie has to be bad, right? And I think in a lot of ways, the Hillary campaign, you know, as a political strategy that wasn't wrong, needed to come to places where see Bernie's not a perfect progressive, right? So Hillary is better on abortion because she cares more directly about that issue. It's pretty much like that issue is more central to her ideology, right? And yeah, that's fair, right? But Bernie has 100% rating from NARAL over his career, or Planned Parenthood over his career. So the idea that he's ever done anything anti-choice is ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. Bernie's a mayor who was celebrating gay pride parades in the 80s. But let's talk about the civil libertarian thing, right? Bernie is like this interesting mix about has like a very like pro free speech, pro free assembly ideology, which at points, oddly, early in his life, I talk about this in the book, once put him at odds with the ACLU as mayor, where he allowed Chabad to erect their menorah on City Hall in Burlington and then fought for it, basically said, yeah, if any religious group wants to erect symbols on City Hall property, we should, like, I want the community to gather. If you're doing a nice community gathering, come on in, guys. If Chabad wants to light a, you want to light a menorah, you want to light a Christmas tree, you want to do whatever, you come on in. You, if you're doing something nice for the community, I am for it as mayor, right? Mm-hmm. I don't care who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And got into a fight with the ACLU and actually had the Rabbi Schneerson, who was kind of the, in the Chabad community, the revered head of the Lubavitcher movement, write him a letter basically like praising him and thanking him, which I quote in the book, for his support. But the truth is that's where Bernie comes down. If, you know, he came out when Trump got thrown off of Twitter, he came out and was criticized from the left for saying he was uncomfortable with this. And I had actually written a column for Jacobin kind of in my time off from Bernie world after the campaign. I wrote a piece for Jacobin talking about something similar where I said, like, I think this call for like social media to take a more aggressive stand, I think it's a real trap for progressives because we should be wary of corporate power here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or anybody to be the arbiter of either speech or truth.
Mm.
Is the truth, because I don't trust them. I don't trust them to be the arbiter of, I don't trust them to be the arbiter of speech or truth.
Right.
And I just don't. And therefore, and I think Bernie took a lot of flack for saying when Trump got thrown off, saying, yeah, I'm uncomfortable with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's remarkable that that's like a position outside of the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Another thing that happened really quickly. And again, I think that probably was, if anything, politically expedient for Bernie Sanders. But again, the Democratic Party seems to be so out of touch now that they missed that. I want to ask, actually, there's so many good anecdotes in this book, by the way. You know, when you're cleaning blood out of a hotel room, it's a hell of a story.
That anecdote is in the New Republic printed today. If people want a preview before they buy the book, so the New Republic has that up as a kind of excerpt on their website, the story of the blood on the bathroom floor.
It's a great story. I'm glad that the New Republic printed it, because that's a good way to whet people's appetite. You also mentioned that he sometimes just like watches flash mob videos and old videos of Gilda Radner.
Yeah, he once asked me about, he was like, what about doing something to promote those events? And I was like, what events? He's like, I've watched them on YouTube, Ari. It's like, suddenly somebody's playing a violin and then like a cello comes in. It's like a flash mob. He's like, yeah. He's like, those are great. But here's the point for Bernie. That's part of what politics are about, right? It is about community and people coming together. And he saw that as like nice and community driven, that a band would show up in a town square and play. Is that's part of his idea of community, right? He, at every rally we did on the campaign, right, his big questions when we were setting up rallies, and we did 300 of them in the course of the campaign, was who is the band, what band is playing, right? Mm. And this is incredibly important to him. And I would say probably at 250 events, we had bands. And, you know, a bunch of times we were lucky enough to have like very, very famous bands, Vampire Weekend, Public Enemy, The Strokes.
Brandi Carlile.
Brandi Carlile. That story is a good story in the book, the airport. Yes. Brandi Carlile story. To divert for a second, we were going through security at McCarran, what then McCarran, now Harry Reid International Airport in Las Vegas. And this woman in a cowboy hat comes like running up to Bernie Sanders And it's only, we were there. There were only two staffers with him during the presidential campaign right at the start. And she was like, "Hey, I'm a big fan." And she's with her partner very clearly. I'm a big fan. Can I get a picture? Of course. She turns to me and the other staffer, this guy Terrell, who's staying there. She's like, "I'm a huge fan of Bernie's. I'm a musician. If you ever need to me to play, my name's Brandy. Here's my phone number, right? Here's my cell number. You call me." It's like, "Great. Thank. And I was like, "Okay, it's some bait, whatever. We'll call, right?" And so the next day I'm back at headquarters. Somebody's like, "Did Bernie meet Brandy Carlisle yesterday?" "Oh, I have Brandy Carlisle's phone number in my phone now."
That's awesome.
I was like, "Great. Yes. Yeah." And she came and played a rally. She was in Vermont and he was doing a rally in Montpelier, and she came. But the point was, you could have Brandy Carlisle, but it was just as important to him if you're in Kentucky to have a local bluegrass band. If you're in Madison to have some garage band of some college kids, right? It didn't matter where, it didn't matter what. Do you have like a fun local band that can play? Because political events shouldn't just be boring speeches by politicians. They should be something fun for people. And that means music, that means entertainment, that means something
community
driven. Can you do something beyond politics? And even just having people have a new, like we were in like Milwaukee and had this like amazing reggae band, which is not what Milwaukee's known for, but like the crowd was like loving it. It also was a funny scene watching a bunch of people, Wisconsinites outside of Milwaukee, swaying to reggae music. I'm gonna say, I know that's your home state, but
it's not our forte. Yeah,
it was a scene, but everybody loved it, and that's what Bernie politics is about: community. It's about people coming together, and it's about it doesn't. And his thing is, it doesn't have to be even people I agree with. I want everybody to feel at home and everybody to feel like they can have a place in their community. One other anecdote that I don't think is in the book, but it's just, as mayor, Bernie created one of the premier punk rock venues in the country. Because he had a youth center in Burlington constructed, and he let the youth control the programming at their own youth center. And at a time in the 80s when punk rock had real problems in a lot of cities attracting venues, because the kids controlled the programming, all these like major punk bands toured this venue in Burlington because they could always get in because the kids would always book them.
That's amazing. Well, okay, so there's so much in this book that's interesting. His spat with Facebook. I mean, he's face to face with the executives at Facebook. He's getting sweet talked by Sheryl Sandberg and just gets up and walks out of the meeting. You mentioned earlier how central you saw Facebook to your campaign. Bernie sort of famously did, I think that maybe it was on Instagram, the sit down with Cardi B. But there was a suspicion, and the Journal, I think, ended up reporting this out, that they were tweaking the algorithm to hurt progressives. And Bernie confronted them over this, right?
Well, it's even before. So there, it's like a series of meetings. You kind of put them together, but it was in a series. Mm-hmm. So we had the campaign Facebook page and we had the Senate Facebook page, right? And the Senate Facebook page served this real purpose of like talking about issues and talking about the business of the Senate and doing this stuff and doing that kind of work. And at some point, and all our social media was growing gangbusters. And then one day the Senate social media literally just stopped growing out of nowhere. And this was very strange to us. It didn't make sense. And we started talking to Facebook about it, and they first denied it, and there was a series of meetings about how the algorithm works, how the news feed works. And Bernie started getting interested in this, not because of his Facebook page, but overall, Facebook is suggesting they be a communications mechanism for government websites, right? But they are telling who can see what he communicates with his constituents should be controlled by Facebook. And there's a series of meetings with that include some of the highest level Facebook executives, Adam Mosseri, who now runs Instagram, but was head of the newsfeed, came into the office. He had a phone call with Sheryl Sandberg that, you know, she was oddly obsequious during the phone call. Like, it was a very strange phone call. very obsequious. So Facebook, you know, we're having all these conversations. They continue throughout the year. Post 2018 election, we had a meeting with them. And this was after there was an incident in the lead up to the 2018 election where there were a bunch of, you could see all the advertising, and a bunch of pages appeared, advertisements with Bernie's picture saying, Bernie wants you to vote against the Democratic candidate. And look, that is not a free speech issue. You can't, like, blatantly lying like that is not like blatantly using someone's image to lie is not within the bounds of what we communicate as free speech, right? It's like advertising a complete falsehood is not like that falls under a numerous law violations. And we went to Facebook and we said, these paid ads are claiming Bernie Sanders' face and mantle and saying something he doesn't believe in these cases. And they said, oh, sorry. They pulled the ads down 3 days before the election. They put the ads back up and they said, these ads comply with our guidance. This is a legitimate group. And the group had no name, hadn't filed with the IRS. There were no records of the group filing with the IRS or the FEC in any way. The group was spending, you know, a lot of money, well in excess of FEC thresholds for filing independent expenditure reports. And we were like, how is this? Have you reported this to the FEC? Because they're not filing. It's not our job to report those things. It's like, it's not, but they're clearly in violation of the law. Right. Vice sent somebody to the address that this group gave Facebook for, because you have to give an address when you put up a political ad, didn't exist at the address. And we were like, how are you doing this? Like, how are you claiming you're being responsible when you're allowing something that is a blatant lie by clearly a group that doesn't exist, which, by the way, as soon as the election was over, all the pages of the group disappeared and they never existed or filed anything. So somebody was able to spend a bunch of money putting ads up in districts saying that Bernie that looked like they were from Bernie, taking a position that Bernie didn't take and then disappeared. And Facebook was like, sorry. And like, we had that issue, but we still had this algorithm issue. And we were talking and they came into the office and we had this town hall that it flopped. And it actually surprised us that it flopped. It was like AOC on the Green New Deal, which is like on the left is like, you know, you don't get much more like, hey, I want to see that. Then this is like 2018 AOC on the Green New Deal is like as good as it gets in terms of programming. And they came in and these were some lobbyists for Facebook. And they were like, well, if you do things differently, if you cover this issue and not this issue, or maybe if you have this person, not this person. And Bernie was like, are you telling me you as Facebook should tell my office what to say to its constituents? And you will, and that's your, and you think you have the right to tell a government office how to communicate with its constituents? And you should decide because of what issues it communicates on or how it communicates what constituents see? And Facebook was like, yes.
Yeah, that was I was fascinated that they just owned up to that.
They just owned up and said, yes, we should decide that. And Bernie just walked out of the meeting. He was like, I'm done with this. Like, you guys handled the meeting. Are you? And he like walked out. And this very junior Facebook lobbyist was like, well, maybe things would be different if your boss wasn't a miserable old coot. Ooh. Which, like, let's be clear. Like, I've been on the Hill a long time and I'm not the most like hilly person. Like, I don't abide by every form of decorum when I've been on the Hill. But one basic one is you don't get to insult a senator in their own office like that.
No.
Like if you're a lobbyist, you don't do that. And I like literally point to the door as I get out. And they were like, what? And I was like, you don't, I was like, what? And the senior lobbyists are kind of freaking out a bit. And they're like, sorry. And like, they give the girl a chance to apologize, the woman a chance to apologize. And she's like, well, I worked for Chuck Schumer and he's a miserable old coot too. Like, that's not the best apology I've ever heard.
That, no, it's not at all. But it's funny because it does this sort of the I've kept you like way longer than I said it would. I'm so grateful for your time because this is a fun conversation. But one thing you really are trying to do with this book, and maybe this is a good place to wrap up, it's you're trying to demystify Bernie Sanders, which is interesting because he's so well known and so beloved, but despite the fact that he really is not, you know, he's not a glad hander like Bill Clinton necessarily, not in the exact same way, because he's not walking around BSing people and pretending, you know, to be this guy that he's not. At one point you say when he's going to get his heart procedure, he's talking to the EMTs about healthcare.
Yes, amazing. So I'm like in the front of the ambulance, right? We've been at the urgent care. They've taken arteries blocked. We're literally being rushed to a hospital to get the stent put in. And he's in the back with the EMT. And during the heart attack, you know, there was never a critical moment where he like clutched his chest. It was never like that. He was always awake and conscious. So he's talking to the EMT in the back and he's like, so do you have insurance? How much do you pay for it? Like, he's having the conversation he would have with the EMT at a town hall in the back of the ambulance on the way to the hospital. But here's the thing about Bernie. He's not a glad hander in the political sense, but he loves talking to people. He kind of hated whenever we felt we had to put a barrier between him and people, which, let's be clear, for security purposes, for someone of his stature, you have to do at times to keep people safe. He wanted to reject that. He loved to jump into crowds and like talk to people and have conversations. And he loved in a way, as long as we could on the campaign. And I think this is one of the reasons he delayed it, flying commercial up until late August, early September. We were flying commercial, which on a presidential campaign is not an efficient or responsible time management thing. And like, finally, it just became, we had this week where like every flight got canceled, every connecting flight got canceled, which you can imagine like destroys your schedule, right? It just doesn't. Commercial air travel in America is, when you're flying like 20 flights a week and half of them are getting canceled, you just can't manage a campaign like that, right?
Right.
But one of the things he liked was being in airports, which is totally an unfiltered environment. When you're in O'Hare Airport, people can talk to you and you can talk to people, which, you know, one of the funny stories I have in the book, one anecdote was, we were in O'Hare Airport. I don't know if you remember this one. And there's a bookshop across from this restaurant called the Black Hawk Grill in one of the terminals. And he walked into the bookshop and there was somebody there reading one of the 2016 like campaign memoirs and books. And he like walked up behind them and he was like, don't believe everything you read.
So good. It's also like when you were wondering what he was laughing at, he was reading a book on his iPad and it was shattered.
Yes, he was just sitting there. I was like, he's maniacally laughing on the campaign, like just cracking up constantly. It's like, what is he reading? And he was reading Shattered, the Jonathan Allen book. I was like, oh.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And look, that iPad, as you said, he has a lot of interesting... He has interesting tastes. He loved like old Saturday Night Live episodes, boxing matches. He does like a lot of the YouTube content.
Bernie Sanders, YouTuber. That's great. Well, this book really, like I said, I mean, for all of the political differences between the Bernie Sanders camp and probably the Federalist listeners, I just think your insight, it's so helpful. And he is one of the most consequential figures in American history, but let alone, you know, the century. And so I thought the book was really well done, Ari. And you'll, if you will come back, I would love to talk to you about your American prospect profile comparing Sanders to Teddy Roosevelt, because I think that is a fantastic discussion too.
Sure, I'd love to. I can come back anytime.
Really appreciate it, Ari. This is, you know, a rare, I think, opportunity for us to actually have these conversations. So it's greatly appreciated. The book is called The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders. Ari Rabenhoff, also, you did the photography for that book. You're somehow like the Dos Equis man. You're scuba diving with sharks. You're taking pictures. You're everywhere, Ari.
Yes, I have some interesting life traits. I do enjoy photography. Not to like pat myself on the back, but people do think I have some talent for taking pictures. So a lot of the pictures in the book were my photos. And yes, I also have this weird thing where I like to go take pictures of very large sharks in their natural habitats without
at
a cage.
Sharks.
Because with I do have the Instagram handle at sharks. So those are my pictures. If you want to see some great whites, some tiger sharks, some hammerheads, you can go to at sharks on Instagram. Also at Ari Rabenhoff and at Ari Rabenhoff on Instagram and Twitter. Is like my more non-shark content, though I do have a lot of sharks on my Instagram, my personal Instagram, but at sharks on Instagram, is also my page.
Yeah, the photography is fantastic. The picture on the cover of the book is excellent, and that was taken by Ari. So the book, again, The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders, make sure you check it out. It really is very insightful.
And the picture, by the way, not to extend this podcast.
Yeah, please.
It was a really thought out thing, because the standard kind of design for a Bernie Sanders book is like Bernie in front of a large crowd, you know, doing something on stage. Right. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time thinking about what we wanted the cover to be. And this image struck us because it's not that. It's an image of Bernie praying, which I think is the rarest of Bernie photos.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting with Jesse. The photo itself is, it's just him on the cover, but the photo itself is him sitting with Jesse Jackson in prayer. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a striking photo that goes to the actual title of the book and what it means. And I think it really, we wanted something dramatic that spoke to that. And it is one of my favorite photos I took on the campaign.
It's an excellent photo. And you can, again, you can follow Ari for more of that, and you can check out the book for these insights and for the pictures as well.
Or shark photography. If you're like not into any of the politics, but want to see pictures of sharks, follow me for that.
The shark pictures are good. I looked at the shark pictures. The shark pictures are good, Ari. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jasinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.